Happy Friday, everybody. It's the Information's 411, your weekly podcast from the reporting team and company at The Information. My name is Tom Dotan. I'm one of those people. Maybe I'm company. So here's today's episode, chock full. First off, I'm talking to Amir Efrati about DoorDash. He got some financials on the company and where they're looking at this year. Big loss, spoiler alert, but also what it means for the food delivery space and for Uber Eats, its biggest competitor, one of its biggest competitors. And then we also talk about Uber, which put out a report earlier this week about sexual assaults on that happened in Ubers and kind of what it means, the number itself, greater context, and an important topic. And then I'm talking to Alex Heath, who had a pretty amazing story about Magic Leap. He got their sales figures for the year. They're not looking very good. Other issues that the augmented reality company is having. This is one of the more interesting tech companies based out of Florida for sure. And Alex Heath really digs into it. Really, if you are interested in the future of optics and augmented reality, you're going to want to read this story. And let's just say there was a little bit of blowback for Magic Leap after the story came out, which Alex and I talk about. But first off, very excited to have in the podcasting booth Pete Schultz, our head of product and business, to talk about a product coming out from, a product from The Information, our first ever app. And Pete's going to tell us about it. So Pete, tell us, our listeners, about Tech Top 10. What is Tech Top 10?
Well, thank you for having me, Tom. This is my second appearance on
the podcast.
That's
right. It's been a few
ever.
Years, though.
I think it's been 4 years since I was on the
first,
podcast.
Future List.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, but thank you for having me on. I'm really excited about Tech Top 10, obviously. It's been a project that we've been thinking about for, I think, years in terms of creating a mobile app. Now just felt like the right time. So what it is our team, our editorial team, so you, putting together the top 10 tech stories of the day at any given moment. And we are serving that through a mobile app. It's coming with the analysis, very similar to our briefing product, from our reporters. One of the big things here is that it is actually curated by our editorial team. So
right.
That top 10 ranking is happening by editors and not algorithms,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a really important
sure.
distinction.
Yeah, yeah. So if people that are familiar with the briefing, this is a way to kind of get that style of content with a little bit more flavor on it because we're ranking the most important tech and kind of media and other kind of tech influence stories of the day. And it is free for subscribers. So if you are an Information subscriber, you have access to Tech Top 10.
Yes, that is correct. If you're an Information subscriber, you have access to Tech Top 10. You can also access articles through the app if you're a full Information subscriber.
Right.
If you are not an Information subscriber, Tech Top 10 is $29.99 a year,
mm-hmm.
With a 7-day free trial, or it is $2.99 a month.
Right. So we're talking a much lower price point than The Information's annual subscription. So
yes.
And exciting for us also because there's a lot of opportunities with this app. You know, like you said, you can access articles from it, potentially things like the podcast and other products maybe kind of push through that app. So a lot of opportunity there.
Lots of opportunities. We have a lot of ideas for the future, this is truly only the beginning.
Yeah.
Just to note a few of the other things in the app already, we also have a list of all the upcoming tech events.
Right.
That you can add directly to your personal calendar, which I actually love because
yeah.
I always forget about
conferences,
these
things of that nature.
Conferences, earnings calls, product launches, those
mm-hmm.
types of things.
Yeah.
So that's a really good value add.
Yeah, sure. And my favorite feature in there beyond just, my briefs are that we also have a way to contact the reporters and the reporting team here. And if you have a tip or information that you think you should pass along to us, plenty of ways that we detail in the app to be able to do that. Yeah, super exciting. Well, anyway, it is available now on the App Store for iOS and for Android. And if you have any questions about it, you should email Pete. I would say, Pete at theinformation.com or what the hell?
Peter at theinformation.com.
I'm sorry, Peter at theinformation.com or Tom at theinformation.com. Super exciting, Pete. Thank you so much for joining. And let's get on to my interview with Amir.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, Amir, two stories this week, one that we broke, another that came from a company, but you had a brief on it as part of our important briefing and Tech Top 10 app. But let's start off with the story. So DoorDash, one of those food delivery companies, raised a ton of money. People have expected it and reported that it will go public in the not too distant future. But the numbers are pretty brutal. So tell me what you've learned looking into DoorDash's finances.
Well, it's important to take a step back for a second and talk about what's happened in the past 2 years. Obviously, it's been great for people like us who, you know, use these apps, use these services. It's been nice to have a proliferation of options.
Subsidized options that are cheaper than they probably would be otherwise.
Although some of them are quite expensive, the fees do add up.
I just got a huge refund from Caviar, which is owned by DoorDash, because they messed up my order.
Oh,
and that's something they took a huge loss on. I recognize.
Well, yes, I mean, I remember the days of, you know, $20 Ubers, you know, going between Palo Alto
right.
and San Francisco. So.
Right, there's a belt tightening, but still.
So yeah, I think that. One of the most interesting things about DoorDash is that its market share was quite small. I think about 13%, 13%, 2 years ago. And what happened was they got a ton of money from SoftBank at the same time that SoftBank made a huge investment in Uber, although much of that was buying out existing shareholders of Uber. But I never thought that that would happen. And the reason is that, usually when SoftBank has more than one option, let's say in food delivery, they'll threaten a company that they will go invest in, you know, their competitor in order to get the deal done. So they'll say to somebody, hey, if you don't take our money, Uber, if you don't take our money, we'll give it to Lyft or whatever.
Right.
So when
the SoftBank strategy is essentially our money is the game changer. Like we will shift the center of gravity to the company that we invested in because we pumped so much in there.
That was the flawed thesis.
Yeah.
But at the time, I didn't take that seriously because I was like, why would they invest in DoorDash if they can invest in Uber Eats, which is bigger and has like all these apparent advantages? Mm-hmm. But they did both. They did both deals, which was a huge surprise and a huge letdown for Uber, which lobbied very hard. Dara Khosrowshahi, the CEO of Uber, tried to kill that deal and failed to do it. So they got all this money, and that really set them on a course to grab a ton of market share, not only by spending more money on marketing, but just recruiting a lot of people and having a much better strategy than Uber. And they really did out-execute Uber in a variety of ways. We get into some of that in the story related to their ability to have the kind of selection of restaurants that Uber still doesn't have, and how they were really smart in understanding like customer psychology of like caring about delivery fee amounts, but not caring about service fee amounts, even though they're the same thing, or could essentially be the same.
Tiny tweaks in the app that make apparently a huge difference when it comes to customer relationship with the app.
You know,
weird.
A-B testing, data science, they did it right.
Bizarre.
And Uber didn't. Uber had to catch up on these product fronts. And that's kind of surprising. But in other ways, you know, there's just a lot of red tape at Uber, and they haven't been able to catch up on some of this selection problem or selection inferiority relative to DoorDash. So DoorDash did a lot of things right. It's still a business that's losing considerable money, but it's much, much more efficient than Uber Eats. And Uber Eats is obviously a more global service. They don't just operate here, but they operate in places where, they're just losing a ton of money. But DoorDash is clearly much more efficient than Uber Eats overall. And that's, you know, it's one of these things where we thought the opposite was going to happen. We thought that because Uber has drivers, that they'd be, that the cost of kind of getting those drivers to do food deliveries would be a lot lower than for a startup like DoorDash that didn't have that marketplace to begin with. I guess we were wrong. And so they have grown. The amount of like vitriol or competition between these companies is pretty high. I only kind of got a sense of that after our story ran.
Really?
And, you know,
getting feedback from people.
Yeah. It was so fascinating because one person texted me that I was wrong and I was being misled, and DoorDash is so much smaller, and how could I fall for this trap? And they're just trying to like bluff an IPO so they can sell themselves to. Anyway, that's not correct. I mean, our reporting is solid. Obviously, we don't know what performance is going to be in December, but we do know what the company has projected. As for whether they hit those projections is another matter.
But the bottom line is that, you know, and this shouldn't be a surprise because the Uber Eats numbers are kind of brutal. Certainly more than you had initially thought, which I know is a whole other story. But this is still not a money-making business, right?
Right, and it's similar to ride-hailing, though. Like, if you look at ride-hailing in the U.S., there has been... people in the industry use the word rationalization or mm-hmm. markets becoming rational. And what they just mean is that companies are less willing to lose a ton of money in, you know, trying to gain market share. And so they sort of settle down and they say, all right, we're happy with our market share. Let's just try to make some money. And everyone kind of agrees to that. So they reduce the amount of money that they pay to drivers and they reduce the number of promotions for customers. And that does have that does cause a slowdown in growth, but it also allows them to get closer to making money. So the belief is that we're still in this crazy period for food delivery, but it's going to have to ramp down. It's inevitable.
That's very similar to the argument with rideshare, though, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. But there is, I mean, clearly on ride hailing, that is moving in the right.
Sorry.
That is, yeah. I will never call it ride sharing because most of it is not.
It hasn't been
actually.
That for a long time. Yeah.
It's just I know that that's a term that these companies would love us to use.
Sure.
Because
it's
implies
sharing economy.
Yeah, it implies, but that's not what's going on.
Right. Anyway,
I think it's still most of the time a single occupancy.
It's a taxi
vehicle.
Service. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's kind of a fascinating space. I think that some people were surprised and were expecting that. DoorDash's projections would be a lot worse than mm-hmm. they were. So relative to expectations, I think they're much better. But we don't. We'll see when the end of the year comes where they actually end up.
Yeah, and last thing on this, I mean, you know, IPO looming is the way that we kind of phrased it in the story here. There's certainly been a lot of signaling that this is going to happen. Yet we have Uber and Lyft on the public markets. None of them are doing very well. We saw the WeWork IPO scuttle for a number of reasons, but among them that their losses were brutal. Is it realistic that the public markets are going to accept another money-losing Silicon Valley company that has no direct path to profitability?
Depends on what that company can show. The growth for DoorDash is like, I don't know, 150%, 180% right now, year over year. That's considered quite good growth, given their size. So you get rewarded for that. And then if you are more efficient than your rivals, you get rewarded for that too. So if they can show that they're more efficient than everyone else, that's pretty huge. As for unit economics, I don't know how they're going to show the way that they can be profitable in certain places or how they can show where they are doing well. I think there's reticence to give too much information because there's still a lot of capital swashing around. So like if one company says they're doing really well in like Miami and their margins are incredible, then maybe the other companies will go in there and try to match that. So it's hard to know, but you're right to have skepticism because at the end of the day, we're dealing with a marketplace of customers and drivers, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen when the economics for the drivers gets worse.
Right.
And it does make things a lot harder. There's still a lot to play out there, and like losing $500 million in a year is not ideal. But there are signs that DoorDash is clearly more efficient than Uber Eats, and we haven't seen Postmates' numbers, so I'm really curious to see.
Another company who that had an IPO expected that looks like it's been pushed off till who knows when. I want to switch quickly to, you mentioned Uber through Uber Eats, but the company had another moment in the news yesterday, and I'm sure for days to come, when they released I would say long-awaited within the industry. Transparency report, I guess you'd call it, about the number of sexual assault allegations, whatever you want to call it, that happen in Ubers across the world. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but from what I recall,
it was U.S. only.
I'm sorry, shit. So number of sexual assaults that happened in Ubers or alleged to have happened in Ubers in the U.S. And the number was 3,000 or around 3,000. Correct.
So a better way to look at it is 9 times a day in the U.S. there is some form of sexual assault reported. That could be, you know, somebody touching your arm inappropriately, or your some body
sure,
part.
Sure. Unwanted touching.
Yeah,
sure.
Unwanted touching. But the most interesting thing about this is that 45% of the time, the party being accused of sexual assault is the passenger, not the driver. And that's something that I actually did not expect. I thought it would be more like 75-25 or,
right.
you know.
Right.
But I think that's one thing that just within the industry.
This is a risk for drivers, too. It's not just one for,
exactly.
for passengers, which, you know, that's sort of been the mentality or I don't know, narrative you'd think of, you know, being in an Uber. Oh, this is not safe. You know, that's especially for women.
Yeah. And look, I mean, in terms of rapes, I think there are about 250 rapes a year, for this service. So that's like, you know, one every other day, at least. It's not ideal. However, I mean, these are the worst things that can happen. I do think, to the company's credit, first of all, they released this 84-page report, and it's really good. They're the first to do it. Lyft has promised to do the same thing. They haven't yet. They haven't set a timetable. It's really nice to see this. It's really good that they've done this.
Mm-hmm. There's no real comp. I mean, you mentioned
it's
Lyft.
It's difficult to compare.
You know, I don't think there's a large taxi cab report to that effect. I've seen people try to compare it to like the New York City, you know, metro system, but that's, you know, those that get reported to police, which is a whole other level of kind of, that's a different standard, I imagine.
Right, exactly. And I do think that one thing that I've been keeping in mind and I've been thinking a lot about is that the number of people who use these services rather than drive drunk is significant. So I have to imagine, even though nationally drunk driving deaths have stayed pretty flat, I have to imagine that these services do have an impact on reducing drunk driving, and that counts for something, right?
Right.
That's a huge problem as well. So I think overall the statistic was like one out of every about 700,000 rides. One out of 700,000 rides, there's some sort of problem, either a sexual assault or something worse.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just thinking about it as a passenger, and if you're just thinking about it as like a female passenger, we're talking about like one out of every 2 million rides.
Right.
There'll be some sort of problem. You know, people can look at that statistic and come to different conclusions,
right.
and that's all reasonable. Like, you know, any rape is too many rapes. Any murder is too many murders. But just personally, I look at that and I think, well, that's a relatively safe service. And they have been doing a lot on the product side to try to make it very easy to call for help. And I think some of these things have had a little bit of an impact. And now they're saying they're going to share data with Lyft and other companies if they ban a driver. That was one of the big criticisms.
Sure.
They kept all this information about bad people to themselves. They didn't share it with anyone. And so they got a lot of heat for that. They got a lot of heat for trying to like minimize their liability and having these like groups of people to try to deal with these complaints quietly and quickly and kind of like, you know, get rid of these problems. And those reports are valid and worth reading. But I think I think overall it's really nice that we have, you know, these
it's a
these
step
numbers.
In the right direction. Yeah.
Definitely.
And I imagine maybe what will happen is, you know, this maybe will push Lyft to do something. And a 2 years or so, we'll see kind of academic studies where we can maybe put better perspective on what these numbers actually mean.
Yeah. And now these companies are competing on safety.
Right.
That's great. Like, that's a really positive. That's a really positive thing. I mean, Uber for the past year has been trying to make a lot of noise about all these safety features that they're putting in their app. And I think that the fact that they're putting resources into that can only be a good thing, not a bad thing.
Right. All right, Amir, thanks for filling us in and have you back on here soon.
Anytime.
All right, we've got Alex Heath on the line here, reporter out in New York, soon to be reporter in LA, and alleged asshole. we'll get to that, to talk about Magic Leap. So this is a company that all of us have paid in the Valley close attention to as they've, you know, raised a ton of money, made a lot of bold claims about their augmented reality technology or mixed reality technology. But you got a deep look into kind of how the business is actually gone since they finally put a real product out there. So, I mean, Heath, what did you learn basically when getting a sense of what the Magic Leap hardware businesses has been doing?
Yeah, so I really set out with this story to just check in with folks and see where is Magic Leap, because obviously we all remember when they first came on the scene years ago with glossy magazine profiles saying they're going to disrupt, you know, the future of computing with these AR goggles that they wouldn't show to the public but promised were coming. And then in August of 2018, all of a sudden, the headset is finally out in the world, their first headset. And they threw a splashy developer conference in LA last year with hundreds of attendees and started talking about the device more and selling it. And it costs, you know, it's an expensive device. It costs more than $2,000. But, you know, this was the moment that everyone had been waiting for.
Right. A moment some people thought would never happen, right?
Right. This was just after years of hype. And, you know, we did some reporting a few years ago, kind of looking at, you know, when they were raising money, what was the state of the actual technology? And we just saw at the time that the devices they were using to sell investors on the technology were not at all what they were actually planning to ship, just because the technology wasn't ready for the form factor of wearable glasses. And so I just wanted to check in and see, okay, this device has been out in the wild for over a year. We saw that recently Magic Leap confirmed that they're raising another round of money. They already raised over $200 million earlier this year. They're raising over $500 million more currently. They've raised over $2.5 billion to date. They're the most richly funded AR hardware company of the last decade. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to see, you know, how was this headset received, and how is the company doing? And honestly, what I found is that they've had some trouble in the wake of kind of mismanaging demand for their first headset. We report in the story that they had planned and forecasted to sell over 100,000 of these devices in the first year, and that was a estimate that had been lowered considerably from CEO Roni Adovit's original goal of selling 1 million plus a year.
Right.
So they wanted to sell over 100,000, and in the first 6 months, we report they only sold about 6,000.
Right.
And that wouldn't be that bad if they were on a kind of more flexible supply chain schedule. But we detail in the story how they actually built this vast supply chain capable of churning out, you know, thousands of units a month, a display factory in Florida that can do over 1 million displays a month. They made commitments to suppliers based on higher volume than what they've actually sold. So, you know, that's one part of it. And then the fact that it's a very expensive operation to run. I mean, this company was losing, burning between 40 and 50-ish million a month last year. Alone, I don't have visibility into the finances this year, but we're assuming that it's similar. And there are signs of belt tightening. You know, they've been laying off dozens of employees quietly. There's been some executive departures. The CFO stepped down in the middle of raising. And, you know, I didn't want to make too much a point of this, but, you know, I do think it's of note that they actually did. They assigned their entire IP portfolio to JP Morgan as collateral, which isn't in and of itself an indication that a business is in distress, but it's a sign that their leverage in negotiations with potential funders is potentially not as good as it used to be. So there were a lot of signs that there were some struggles going on, but we kind of detailed in the story that there are. And, you know, I should note they're still plowing ahead, and they're going to, you know, release another headset likely in the next year or so that's more of an iterative update to the current one. And then they're working on a more far-flung, bigger upgrade, a second generation version that is, you know, years away and, you know, remains to be seen when that will actually ship. But that's the current state of things.
Yeah. And so what's the state of things inside the company right now? I mean, Roni Abovitz is kind of a prototypical visionary founder who gets very hyped up about the technology, the possibility of what mixed reality can do, has like a minor online cult that kind of exalts everything that he stands for. But the rubber really has met the road now. There's no, you know, we know what's behind the curtain. We know what the product is. And we now know how little demand there is for it. I mean, if you're working at Magic Leap, How do you feel right now?
Well, it's a good question. I think obviously there's concern that the company may be mismanaging its finances, given the fact that they have no other source of revenue right now other than the headset sales. I say in the story, I give some examples of ways that they tried to seek other lines of revenue, especially in 2018. They bid on a military contract that would have been $500 million to provide AR goggles to the military that Microsoft ultimately won.
Right, would have been game changing, at least for the short term.
It would have been a game changing windfall for a company with no revenue that was burning tens of millions a month. And they also sought a lucrative deal to participate in the Dubai 2020 Expo to build like a city of the future. And that ultimately didn't pan out. So they did try to find sources of revenue elsewhere. But, you know, a common critique I heard from folks while reporting this out is that they were really late to recognize the opportunity, the near-term opportunity for AR, which is the enterprise market. You could go back and listen to Roni Abovitz in interviews talking about, you know, in the run-up to the first headset, talking about what the market was for it and how they were going to position it. And he really wanted it to be a consumer device. You know, I say in the story, he told employees he wanted to have at least 100,000, quote, insanely happy customers. He really wanted this to be like, you know, iPhone 1.0 moment. Like, let's really usher in this new computing paradigm. And what we see is that, you know, the technology just isn't there yet. It's not there for mainstream. And so, you know, had they been a little more cautious with the initial rollout and,
right,
you know, forecasting supply, they may not be in this situation. But
right, which is always the issue with hardware, right? And it reminds me, you know, you and I have both reported on spectacles, Snap's attempt, not into mixed reality, but kind of, you know, wearable video camera based technology. And Snap famously overordered its initial run of spectacles and ended up with a bunch of them left over at warehouses and had to take a write down on it. I mean, these are the downfalls of hardware. How is it that Magic Leap couldn't learn from that kind of very similar and specific instance to not go down that road? I mean, what happened?
I think you can trace a lot of it to the CEO, Roni Abovitz. He has a very flamboyant persona around the technology and hyping it. And, he's told employees he thinks the company will have a $100 billion valuation one day or be the first $1 trillion IPO. He says he's turned down, you know, acquisition offers in the past. He wants to build this massive company, be the Apple of AR, essentially. Really what had to happen was actually a lot of executives around him had to talk him down from that initial more bullish, like, let's do over a million in our first year estimate, because there just wasn't any market data to support it. This is a very founder-controlled, founder-led company with Abovitz, and I think we're seeing that and how
right.
that plays out.
Yeah, a problem to be the Apple of AR when Apple wants to be the Apple of AR. There already is Apple.
Yeah, there's another aspect of this, which in the time that Magic Leap first kind of came onto the scene saying it's building this technology, just about every tech giant in Silicon Valley has spun up their own AR teams to develop glasses as well, with many thinking this could eventually replace mobile phones. So you've got Apple, Facebook, others all investing very heavily in glasses that could come out in the next few years. So Magic Leap is very much like in a game of giants, and it's an incredibly capital intensive thing to do, to make hardware like this, and they want to own the full stack. So that's no laughing matter. It takes a lot of money, and when you don't have any other revenue to support that kind of investment, that's an issue. And you know, I think the reason, you know, they were very Magic Leap, you know, we should say, like, they broadly disputed the story. They didn't address any specifics with us, and the CMO later kind of called me an asshole and said the story was clickbait.
That was internally to employees, right? Yeah, yeah.
They haven't addressed any specifics of the story, so I'd be waiting to see that. And I was just going to say, like, the reason I think Magic Leap deserves more scrutiny as a company is because, you know, they are the most well-funded AR company in the space. And I've actually heard a lot from other entrepreneurs who have either, you know, started AR companies or are currently still running them. And, you know, the perspective is that Magic Leap really, really monopolized a lot of the funding in the environment over the last several years. They've got a very, very, like, big name of brand name investors, from Google to Qualcomm to Alibaba to Andreessen Horowitz, Kleiner Perkins, the list goes on.
Right, right.
Sovereign Wealth Fund. So all that money could have been potentially dispersed more evenly in the industry, and Magic Leap sucked up a lot of it. So I think that there's a lot of pressure on them to actually deliver based on what they told people they were going to put out into the world.
Yeah. Last question on this, and something you and I were chatting about before we started recording, is that there's an element of this that I always find kind of frustrating and confusing about Magic Leap, which is that a lot of the company's promise, and like you say, they've, you know, sucked up so much of the potential AR venture capital funding, was that these guys were you know, leaps and bounds ahead of where everyone else was in augmented reality. That even though you had companies like Microsoft and now like Apple pursuing this technology, somehow what they were doing was in a different league than the rest. And I think we're finding out that that just isn't the case. I mean, what to make of that? That this one kind of startup in Florida, which, you know, no offense to Florida, but doesn't have a ton of tech companies, would somehow be, you know, in a different hyperspace than the other more well-funded, you know, massive companies with this one piece of technology?
It's a great question. I mean, I think it speaks to the company's ability to fundraise and out of its, and, you know, the people he surrounds him, you know, surrounds himself with, their ability to sell the vision. Obviously, they've done that. And although we should note, like, you know, like marquee board members like, you know, Google, Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai, Paul Jacobs from Qualcomm have stepped off. So they're beginning to lose a little bit of that AAA kind of name recognition. But, you know, yeah, they've managed to draw all this attention and say that they had something that was much better. And the current device in the market is very safe to say not leaps and bounds better than anything else. And
right.
So, sure, they may come out with a headset in a few years that is ahead of whatever Apple puts out. But, you know, as we reported, we know Apple is eyeing 2023 to release glasses that are similar to Magic Leap. So, you know, if you're in the space, who are you putting your money on? Are you putting it on Apple, or are you putting it on Magic Leap? So the environment around them has certainly gotten a lot more competitive now. And so the pressure to actually have a meaningfully better product is higher than it's ever been.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, look, we have a bit of a history at the Information Reporting on Magic Leap, as you mentioned, and very happy to pass the mantle of Magic Leap Reported the Information to you, Alex. excellent story. I don't think you're an asshole. Other things,
no,
but not that.
It.
So glad to have you on, and look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Tom.